Hello, and welcome to Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. I'm a classical music musician, a music educator, and a music researcher. I sing and study music theory in a PhD program at the University of Michigan. So I read and write about music a lot, I talk about music a lot, and I do all those things a lot on this show with other musicians. Today is our last episode in the season. We've been talking to women musicians for Women's History Month, and today we're finishing off our season with a conversation with Dr. Rachel Lumsden. She's a professor of music theory at Florida State University. We talk about her musical upbringing, how she got into music theory, as well as her experiences in women's and gender studies. And we talk all about her article that came out in Music Theory Online in 2020, titled Music Theory for the Weaker Sex, Olivera Prescott's Columns for the Girl's Own Paper. It's a fantastic article that just won an Outstanding Publication Award from the Society for Music Theory. So make sure you check out the show notes for the links to the article and everything else that we mentioned. Without further ado, here's our conversation. All right, hello everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. I'm so excited for all of the guests that we've had this month for Women's History Month, and I'm really excited to talk to my guest today. She is a music theorist who's currently at Florida State University. So today we have Dr. Rachel Lumsden. Rachel, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me here, and it's so fun to talk to you.
Yes, thank you so much for being willing to speak to me today. I normally start off every episode with talking about how I came to be introduced to a guest or how I came to be familiar with their work. And the first time that we met virtually was when you came to speak at in a class that I was taking here at Michigan with Dr. Karen Fournier. And it was a music theory pedagogy class, and you came to give a virtual lecture, which was really great, all about your work with the Norton Guide to Teaching Music Theory. So thank you for doing that. I really enjoyed that.
You're welcome. It was a really fun visit. It was nice to, I love coming to schools and meeting grad students and other places. So it's always really fun to see the young folks and what they're doing.
Absolutely. I actually just got asked to do my first lecture. So I'll be going to North Carolina Central University soon in a few weeks here, which is going to be really fun. I'm giving a talk about Florence Price and Marian Anderson and about the podcast and to talk to them. And I'm particularly excited because it's an HBCU. So I was invited as a part of their, you know, they have this Black academic lecture series to bring in Black academics to talk about what they do in music academia. So I'm really excited that I got to be included. I'm like, oh my gosh, people, if you're listening and you want me to come to university, just let me know. I'm trying to come and meet all your students. So yes. And I also, again, we'll talk about this more when we talk about your article from 2020, but I briefly said before we were recording that here's the situation. In 2020, I was still in my master's degree at Roosevelt University in Chicago. I went to Chicago College of Performing Arts, a conservatory, for a degree in voice. And I was there studying, and of course it was 2020, so everything had shut down, and I wasn't really enjoying my classes anymore, and it was making taking voice lessons very hard. So that was when I kind of started to really get interested in music theory and music history. They had always been kind of periphery interests of mine, but I was so like on the opera train in terms of like, I'm going to be an opera singer and this is what I want to do. And so music theory as a career was never, you know, a thought in my mind, especially at a conservatory. And so I had started to get into music theory, music history, because those courses were the ones that felt the most normal during that time and the most accessible to me. And I remember my professors kind of encouraging me, oh, you should check out the latest issue of Music Theory Online. So, you know, we have this publication that comes out a few times a year. You should check it out, da, da, da. And so that was the issue that I read. And that was my first time reading music theory scholarship ever. And so I came across your article and I was like, what is this? Now, this is fascinating. So it was a really, like, you know, instrumental piece of scholarship for me in terms of right off the bat showing me how diverse the field could actually be, and that, like, oh, this is written by a woman, like, about a woman theorist, like, you know, hundreds of years ago, who was doing similar work, and, like, that's really interesting. So, like, maybe I could do this. And then bing bang boom, I was applying for my PhD. So, you know, I just want to thank you for this incredible article, which you just won an award for as well, so congratulations for that. So yeah.
Oh, that, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. I'm sure you say that to all your podcast guests, but but I really do appreciate it. You know, it's funny, that article has an interesting origin story, so I won't go into everything about that, but it kind of came about because someone in my life, while I was a PhD student, made a statement about there not being any female music theorists before the early 20th century, like that they just didn't exist. And the feminist in me just really got mad by that statement.
Yeah.
I thought, this cannot be true, right? So I was lucky that I got my PhD from CUNY. So the New York Public Library was just a short train ride away. So I hopped on the subway and went up to the New York Public Library and started just researching in various, like, bibliographies. This was before, this was like around 2005, 2006. So before the internet was quite as crazy as it was for research. So I just went through various bibliographies that the New York Public Library had. And there were lists of names of women who had written about music. Mm-hmm. So I would write down the name, and then I would look in the hard copy of the New Grove because to see if they had an entry, or to try to do a Google search. But, you know, things weren't quite what they are 20 years later now with that. And so Olivera Prescott was one of the names that I found. And it felt really good to write that article, right? To kind of say, see, what you think about music theory is wrong.
Definitely. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. I have so many questions. We're not going to get to it yet. That was a teaser for the listeners.
Oh,
so
sorry.
Stay tuned. I love it. Okay.
You can tell I still have some feelings about this, right? Because
as you should, as do I. So, you know, we're going to get into it. So first, let's start off with talking about you and your personal background with music. So if you could start with informing us how you got interested in music, where you're from and where your family is from, if you have musicians in your family, your early kind of music influences, what you were listening to as you were coming of age, all of that stuff.
Yeah, so I have a pretty, I think, a background that's a little bit different for most music theorists, in that I grew up in a family, no one in my family was a musician. No one in my family can read music. My parents went to college, but I don't have people in my family who got kind of higher degrees in music. Mm-hmm. And I grew up outside of Richmond, Virginia. And I started playing music in sixth grade in middle school band. And I played the flute. And I took some piano lessons when I was in elementary school with, like, a lady who lived down the street. So she taught me a little bit how to read music and play the piano a little bit. I am still a terrible pianist. Okay. I'm just going to be honest about that. I can hack through chord progressions in my theory classes, but no one wants to hear me play the piano at any day. no one wants to hear that. So yeah, I started out as a flute player and got a degree in flute performance. And I actually didn't know that music theory was a field until I got my master's degree at Queens College. And I went to Queens College to get a master's degree in flute performance and to study new music, and started taking theory classes there. I took a class with Bill Rothstein and was just sort of blown away, because up to that point, I thought that music theory was just Roman numeral labeling. which I was very good at, but I wasn't particularly interested in music theory because I thought it was sort of just labeling. And I didn't know that there was this whole field of people who were actually quite interested in deep questions of musical meaning and form and structure and all of these things. So that was kind of it for me. I mean, I started taking the theory classes and then got my master's also in music theory at Queen's College, and then went to the grad center for my PhD. And now I'm a huge theory nerd.
Fantastic. So let's talk a bit about your time in grad school and what you ended up studying and doing your dissertation on and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Dissertation years and grad school years. Yeah, grad school is hard.
Yeah.
If there are any people in grad school listening?
We're right tired. Now, I'm tired.
I just want to tell you, it's exhausting. It's tiring. It's horrible. It's all of those things. But you can get through it. You can get through it and you can do it. Yeah. So I think the grad school experience was interesting. I mean, CUNY, the grad center when I was there, which was from 2007 to 2012, is, you know, quite different than the CUNY right now in 2024. There's different faculty and all sorts of things. But one thing that I did during grad school that was absolutely foundational to who I am now is I got a graduate certificate in women's and gender studies.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah. And so that was an amazing experience, right? I mean, the grad center, I mean, it's in Midtown Manhattan. So it's just one building kind of down the street from the Empire State Building. And the classes that I took in women's and gender studies were on a different floor than the music department. And it just felt so wonderful to like take the elevator to a different floor of that building and walk out and talk about, you know, gender and feminism and race and queerness and all those things with a community of like-minded grad students in other fields. I just felt like it really broadened my thinking. It was a community of support, and I wouldn't be the person that I am today if I hadn't taken those classes. So also, grad students listening, if you have time to pursue a certificate program outside of your main PhD, I really recommend it because it's great to meet friends in other fields. It's so important. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's not to say that like I didn't like the PhD music program there, because I loved it. And I mean, it obviously trained me and prepared me, and I had great advising and all those things, right? So it's not to say that like...
Right, that there's a competition between those two.
Yeah. No, it's not that, but I just felt like it enriched me so much.
Yes.
To be able to have that opportunity. So I really, really recommend trying to do that. Mm-hmm, if your university has something like that, it's so important. Are you doing a certificate?
Yes, that's why I'm so excited. So my certificate is in African American studies and diaspora studies.
Great.
Yeah. And I fully agree that it has been, again, like you're saying, not that I don't really enjoy my music theory classes and the musicology classes and all of that stuff, but it has been so foundational to, first of all, just my experience in grad school in general, meeting other folks that are outside the music department, especially because I don't have Black colleagues, really. There's not a Black, you know, professor in my department. Every time I say this, I'm like baffled that I'm going to be the first Black person to graduate from my department. So there's literally never been somebody who's Black who's graduated from my department, which isn't to say that Black people haven't been admitted to the program. They probably just weren't able to finish. And so it has been really, really foundational to my experience in terms of just like meeting other Black colleagues and other Black professors, and especially knowing that I want to research Black music. I really want to have a Black professor who's on my dissertation committee. And if I can't find that in the music theory department or the musicology department, you know, it's really important for me to be plugged into other departments in the university. And so, yeah, I agree with you that it has totally kind of transformed the way that I think about Black music, to be plugged into Black studies and the conversations that are happening there, the theories and the methodologies that they're developing. It's been really helpful. And I have Black friends now, and I love that. Yes.
And hopefully more than one.
Yes. Once you know, Michigan is still definitely a PWI, right? I think Michigan is only 3% Black, maybe, in terms of the student body. But once you find, like, the Black Student Union and the, like, there's a strong Black grad presence once you find them. So yeah. Now that I found them, we're plugged in, which is great.
Yeah, it's so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone in grad school needs a community of support, like a true community of support. Mm-hmm. No one can get through without that.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And I mean, my friends from my cohort in grad school during the COVID pandemic, when everything shut down, we started meeting on Zoom kind of regularly for Zoom happy hours. Right. And that really helped us kind of get through. So I think these communities of support are really important in all sorts of different contexts.
Yes.
The other thing I'll say is that I really love that you used the word conversations just a minute ago and talking about how the experience with your certificate program enriches you. And I really feel the same. I mean, I feel like at its heart, academic research should be a conversation, right? Mm. It should be a conversation between people. And I feel like if I hadn't gotten that gender studies certificate, I would have been very adept in the conversations of music theory, right? But I didn't really have folks who could help me with the feminist and sexuality piece. So having those conversations with professors in the Women's and Gender Studies program, and also my peers working in like English and comp lit or French, yes, or all history or all these different fields, it was just so helpful to be able to read a piece of feminist scholarship and talk through it, right? To have a conversation, to talk through it with someone else. And I don't think I would have really understood things and internalize them as deeply if I hadn't been able to have those conversations, right? If I'm just like reading something on my own and kind of thinking about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, how do we have, like you're saying, a conversation, a dialogue between fields in a way that is, you know, respectful of where those terms and methods came from? How do we engage and what do we add in terms of, like, it seems clear to us, like, what the field of women's and gender studies, the field of, you know, comp lit, the field of Black studies, like, can add to music theory, but is it clear what music theory can offer back to them? And so, like, yeah, I think that exchange is really interesting in terms of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it happens all the time, right? Where like Black women's voices are erased. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that happens. That's a thing.
Right.
Right. And then I think also a lot of people just aren't aware. Right. I mean, they know the word intersectionality because it's kind of everywhere in the ether in the last couple of years, but they just don't know that this is actually, you know, Black female feminists have been talking about this for decades.
For decades.
Yeah. Right. This is not new.
Yeah.
I mean, this is.
Yeah. So kind
of haven't listened.
Yes.
Haven't listened to them.
Yeah. And kind of adopting it as a buzzword versus engaging what it actually means within the context that it originated, which if we're talking Kimberly Crenshaw was within the context of law too. So it's like, let's talk about that and what it actually came from and where, how people have been talking about that concept before her and all of that stuff. Right. So like you're saying, it's absolutely not new. So yeah, I wonder about that cultural exchange and us as the receivers of all this great work and critical dialogue happening throughout the rest of the humanities so that we can try and catch up to them and the conversations that they're having. But then again, what does music theory offer back to the rest of the humanities? Do our theories and methods and ways of talking about music enrich their fields in turn? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's such a deep question. There's this great article by Robin James. It's like a short thing that she posted on her blog, but it basically asks the same question that, you know, people are often thinking about in music and music theory what other fields can add. But actually, the question should be, how could people in other fields be using music theory, and yes, why aren't they?
Yes.
Right? Why aren't they? And one of the things that she talks about in this eloquent and beautifully provocative blog piece is the issue of notation.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And how notation is such a barrier for people in other fields who may have very astute analytic observations without having any formal music theory training,
yeah,
but don't feel quite comfortable communicating that because they can't read notation,
mm-hmm,
right? So I think this is a really powerful question for us to think about when we're talking about work with other fields is what we're communicating able to be understood by someone who can't read notation? And conversely, I mean, what do people, because we're all in this world listening to music,
yes,
right? And we all have thoughts about it, yeah, right? So how do people who might be expert listeners, mm-hmm, in certain genres of music, but not know what like a 2-6-5 chord is?
Right.
How can we listen to what they say and take it as legitimate music theory, right, without notation? So I don't know. It's a big question, but I think that it relates to these issues of equity, right, mm-hmm, of exclusion, and of interdisciplinary work that we've been talking about.
Yes, absolutely. Listeners, if anybody wants to come on and tackle this big question, send me an email, because we do have to have 4 episodes just about that. So yes, thank you. Again, listeners, check the show notes for all of the links that we're mentioning. So I'll put the links to that piece in the show notes. Yeah. So let's go back to your time in grad school. Can you also talk a bit about what you ended up writing about for your dissertation?
Yeah, great. So the dissertation, my supervisor was Joe Strauss, who's great. Thank you, Joe.
Joe Strauss, come on the show. Please come on the show.
Friend to music theory, yes. Joe Strauss. Great person, great human.
Just put out that whole podcast about analyzing Stravinsky.
Yeah.
I got to listen to an episode or two of that. It's really good.
Yeah, for sure. So he was my supervisor, and I did a project. The basic idea about the project was I wanted to look at women in the early 20th century who were writing experimental music and very modernist atonal music who weren't Ruth Crawford Seger.
Sure.
And that's not because I don't like Ruth Crawford Seger. She is amazing. I'm in love with her.
Yes.
If she hadn't married Charles Seger, I would want to marry her.
Yes.
But I just really felt like music theory scholarship had kind of taken Ruth Crawford Seger and made her the woman composer of atonal music in the early 20th century.
Sure.
And kind of stopped looking, right? So this idea of Ruth Crawford, who's a brilliant, wonderful, amazing composer, There was a kind of tokenism happening there that really, really bothered me,
mm-hmm,
right? This idea of like, if we find one, that's enough and we stop looking.
We've checked the box. Yes.
We've checked the box. Yes, mm-hmm, exactly, right? So I felt really passionately about that. So luckily I was in New York City, so I had everything in the New York Public Library at my disposal. So I would go up there and research in their archives about other women composers. And the dissertation project ended up just, please nobody read my dissertation. Nobody read the dissertation. It was written very quickly because I got a tenure track job at the University of Oklahoma, and I had to finish it quickly so that I could start that job. So it didn't quite go where I originally imagined it would go, but it was something, and I finished and got the PhD, so that was fine. And then I've had all the time since then to work on articles that came from that research. So,
okay, great. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I would love to know if you could offer, you have, as we've been talking, also kind of dropping nuggets of wisdom, but if you have a specific piece of advice that you would give to grad students in a music academic program, anything related to reading academic texts for the first time, research, learning to write, or teaching for the first time, you know, what would you say?
Wow, that is such a big question.
You can give a few.
Okay. this is coming from my own experience, right? And so this is coming from my own subjective position. So take it with a grain of salt, right? Mm-hmm. I would say that I wish that when I were a grad student, I had trusted myself more. I feel like the way that I'm going to rant for a little bit here. I feel personally that the way that grad school is set up, oftentimes there's a feeling of measuring up, of proving one's worth, of showing that you can be a legitimate music theorist or musicologist or whatever you're interested in doing. Mm-hmm. And I get that. I mean, I get that a PhD program is supposed to prepare you to be a professor and a professional. And part of the process is knowing a lot of different things. I get that, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that one thing that often happens is that people start to question themselves, to not trust their ears. And to kind of get away from the person that they are and the unique things that they can bring to the field. So I wish in grad school that I had thought more and like really believed, who am I? How do I hear music? What are the things that I care about? And how can I be, and this sounds super cheesy, but I don't care, I'm going to say it. How can I be like the unique and authentic voice in music theory that comes from my experience and my position that no one else can be, right? How can I talk about and analyze music in a unique and creative way that's my way, that expresses my voice, and to feel confident about that rather than like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know. It's very hard to talk about, right?
It is. Yeah. No, but that does make sense. And it's so much easier to say than to do, especially in grad school. And as you're trying to learn to, like, what I hear you saying is like trying to trust and develop your own voice. And that is really hard to validate when you're first learning to write and first learning to connect ideas and, you know, receiving guidance from your advisors and navigating one's own voice for the first time when you're also, you know, navigating a lot of different opinions about what your voice should sound like and what a music theory professor looks like and what a music theorist should do and can be. It's really challenging. So I hear what you're saying.
It's really, really hard. I mean, I think about the pieces of writing and the things I've read that mean the most to me, right? And I think the things over the years that I've read that mean the most to me are things that have come from a place of creativity and authenticity, right? And uniqueness, right? Uniqueness. I mean, Suzanne Cusick, technically she's a musicologist, but I actually think that she's a great music analyst, and I consider her a music theorist.
Yes, we claim her. Yes.
Yes. I mean, I think about her work a lot, right? I mean, her articles really have meant so much to me over the years, and it's because she, you know, dares to use the first person pronoun. She dares to ask questions, to say that she doesn't know. She dares to talk about the listening experience in a highly personal, sexual way, right? She dares to do it because that's the person that she is, and that's the unique insight that she can offer.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Her chapter in Queering the Pitch was the first. Like, I remember Dr. David Kerr, who's at Roosevelt and is a musicologist there. I remember reading that, and it was so interesting and provocative and, like, you know, was the first piece of kind of music academic writing that, like, really struck me and made me think. And I wrote, you know, a response or whatever that we had to write for class. And that's when he pulled me into my office and was like, you wrote this, and it's really good and really interesting. Have you thought about getting your PhD? And I was like, no, that sounds weird. I don't know why I would do that. And then things kind of spiraled from there. So her work has been also, really, really influential for me.
Yeah, so I feel like, and I mean, you're right what you said a few minutes ago about how it's very easy to say that, be yourself, be
Right.
your authentic self. It's like, well,
And it's
thank
like,
you,
is myself gonna get
tenure
hired? Like,
Exactly.
yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's very easy for me to say that as a tenured professor at an R1 university with a big theory program, right? I wasn't fully myself in grad school, right? I wasn't. So, I mean, I really get the pressure of not doing that. But I wish that I had been.
Right. And I hope that the landscape of music theory in the past 10 or 20 years has shifted enough to where maybe us grad students who are currently in school and currently studying and writing and learning to find our voices, that maybe it would be a little more encouraged that we would be ourselves. Maybe, again, we are still, battling the realities of like, what if being myself means that I can't get a job? Or what if being myself, right, like means that, there's risk there, right? But I would hope that for me and my fellow students that are currently studying and writing, that the landscape has changed enough so that we might be a little more ourselves than perhaps we could have been maybe 20 years ago. So perhaps there's a bright spot there in that, like, on this show, I do feel like myself. And it's really encouraging to me that the society at large has, really accepted the podcast and is encouraging me to do it. And that, especially since the plenary session, I've gained so many new listeners and gotten so much good feedback and encouragement from professors that are tenured and not tenured. And, that's really encouraging to me.
Yeah, I really do. I think you're right about that. I really do think that the field has shifted. I mean, it is by no means as progressive or radical as I would like it to be. And you can leave that in the podcast. But there is, I think, a new level of awareness and openness that I have not seen before. So I think that that is a good starting point for change. I really, really do. So I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing a bit about your story and your journey in music theory. Before we get into your article proper, I'd also just love to touch on your time at FSU and what that has been like and anything that you're experimenting with currently since you're the listen. We had Jenny Snodgrass on the show and I consider you the other, parallel music theory pedagogy queen. So if
Oh
you want to talk about
wow. Well, thank you. I will
so
accept the crown. I
yes.
will accept it
So I
now.
would love
Luckily,
to
they
hear a bit about at FSU anything that you are experimenting with pedagogically or anything in the way that you've structured your program, anything that you and your colleagues are working on, and things like that.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about music theory, I think, is that there's a lot of pedagogy queens. So that is good. And two other pedagogy queens are my colleagues at FSU. So Nancy Rogers and
Yes.
Jane Plendinning, right?
Yes.
So I don't know. Is there a word for like three rulers, a trifecta? I
Yes.
don't know. But anyway. Yeah, I mean I'll tell you a little bit about the pedagogy piece, and then we can talk about FSU more generally. Yeah, so I don't consider myself a kind of pedagogy expert by any means. I care very deeply about teaching, and I co-edited the Norton Guide to Teaching Music Theory with Jeff Swinken, who's at the University of Oklahoma, and that was a really important project to both of us. But I feel like I still am not the teacher that I want to be.
Really?
I'd say, yeah, I mean, I feel like I am always learning how to teach. I feel like I think about my teaching in my classes a lot. And I feel like that is going to be a kind of lifelong quest for me, that I will never really get to exactly where I want to be with that. So, yeah, I think that I care a lot about teaching because I actually, before I was a music theorist, had about 10 years of teaching experience to students on the flute, like private lessons, and also the piano. Again, very rudimentary, like the C position. Don't worry, pianists out there. I was not screwing anyone up. We're talking about like teaching five-year-olds how to touch the piano and play middle C and maybe learn to read music. Don't worry. Right. But I did have a decade of experience in the private realm. And so I feel like I really love teaching and I love chatting with people and working with people and helping them hear music better. So I feel like when I started teaching music theory, I had a lot of skills from that private studio setting that I could kind of bring into the classroom, even though it's obviously different because it's a group of people instead of just one. So it's something that's really important to me as a scholar and a person, and I just try to do a little bit better at it every day. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I do actually at FSU, we have a great program. Apply to our doctoral program, listeners.
Ooh, if you're listeners.
Yeah. We have a lot of faculty there doing a lot of different things. And so because there's a good number of us teaching there, it's not as big as Michigan. We have 7, but it's still a pretty large faculty. So that means that we each get to teach pretty much what we want to. So most of the teaching that I'm doing now is with grad students in seminars that I get to organize and design. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very exciting to me, that freedom. I also do a little bit of supervising. Each of us supervises a course in the undergrad theory or aural skills sequence, one or two semesters of the undergrad theory and ear training sequence. So mm-hmm. I also supervise TAs who teach the fundamentals and then what we call trailing theory one that people take in the spring, either if they had to take the fundamentals class in the fall or if they failed theory one and have to take it again. Mm-hmm. So I'm the course supervisor for that, which means that I work with our doctoral students who are actually in the classroom teaching those classes. Cool. And give them advice and things like that. So
great. Sounds very exciting. Listeners, get your applications in. Sounds exciting.
Yeah. So most of the classes I teach are kind of special topic seminars. Mm-hmm. So I teach a class about analyzing concert music by women composers.
Cool.
And right now I'm teaching a class about analyzing concert music by 20th century composers who are BIPOC or mixed race. Yeah, so that's a really fun class to teach too. Ooh. Although I feel a little strange about it, teaching that class as like a middle-aged white woman. that's a whole different conversation. But
I'm sure your students, appreciate it immensely in terms of kind of the breadth of what your program has to offer them in terms of courses.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, in that particular class, we do not have all of the music theory faculty are white, right? Mm-hmm. So we do not have anyone who is a BIPOC person to teach that class, right? And so I feel like rather than not have a class like that for the students and kind of continue to erase concert music written by people of color, better to just have the class and be honest about, here I am. I don't want to teach this class forever. I'm just kind of doing the best that I can. So at least you'll know about this music. And then hopefully the next generation, there can be a person of color to teach the class mm-hmm. that's on faculty. So I'm thinking of it kind of that way. But it is a class I really enjoy teaching. And
sure. Yeah. Sounds super exciting. Thank you for sharing. Okay, without further ado, the listeners have been waiting with bated breath for us to talk about this article, which again, as I mentioned earlier, is from 2020 and it came out in Music Theory Online. So check the show notes for the links to this article. It's really excellent, called Music Theory for the Weaker Sex, Olivera Prescott's Columns for the Girl's Own Paper. And as I mentioned before, again, I found this to be so fascinating as one of my first pieces of music theory scholarship in terms of an introduction into what music theory can look like, can be, who's doing it, who's writing it, and how are we defining it? And so, yeah, revisiting it, I was like, wow, I forgot how much is here in terms of obviously like gender discourse and talk about feminism, but also in terms of public music theory, and which is, you know, a thing that I'm really passionate about and find really fascinating. So you did give us a bit of kind of a background in terms of how you discovered this paper and how you got into this research. But I'm also wondering how you, because I'm trying to structure a question about like the history of theory and their kind of legacies being erased from the history of theory. So, you know, you did kind of give us a background about how you came across this work and the girl's own paper in terms of looking through archives and finding these names. But I'm interested in kind of your perspective on the history of music theory and why these women that have been involved in music making, whether through composing or through music analysis, why they're kind of, you know, missing from the music history of music theory.
Sexism.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean, my students tell me all the time how I'm like blunt and funny at the same time.
Yes.
So if you're listening, I hope that.
Stay tuned for Rachel's like, you know, stand up comedy circuit where the punchline is sexism.
I wish. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, from my perspective, I know we were just talking about this in one of my classes yesterday. So, One of my students was talking about my musicology colleague, Denise von Glahn, just published a beautiful book about the Guggenheim Foundation mm-hmm. and its practices of exclusion, both in terms of race and gender. So everybody go out and read that book. It's like all of her work. It's just brilliant and wonderful and amazing. But anyway, one of the things that she says in that book is that winners are made, right? Winners are made. And so I feel like that is true in a lot of facets of life, including music theory and the history of music theory, right? In my opinion, existing structural forces of power and privilege, both in terms of gender, sex, and race, have made the voices of white male theorists a dominant force in music theory, and that there are a lot of voices. Olivia Prescott is one, but there are many more that could have been heard that weren't mm-hmm. because of society and history and power structures.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we can listen. I know that Rachel started off with, in my opinion, but that's true. We're not even going to. This is my show. This is true. So.
Well, I basically just said that in case Ron DeSantis was listening.
Absolutely not. Ron DeSantis, if you're listening, don't. You can turn this off. Thank you. This is my show. All right. Well, yes. So yes, that's exactly right. That in terms of the narrative of how the field came to be and who are the most influential and monumental players in, you know, the formation of the field as it stands today, that those voices have always been white men. And it does take some intentional seeking out of other voices that have intentionally kind of been suppressed from the history, right? So I would completely agree there. Also, this work, shout out to Dr. Candice Bailey, who we also just had the show to talk about her fantastic book, Unbinding Gentility. And so this seems to have a lot of parallels there in terms of ideals of womanhood and how they coalesce and are communicated and how music kind of fits into that in terms of women in the private sphere of the home doing their entertaining on their pianofortes and that being, you know, a sign of womanhood or how that develops. And another really great thing that you pointed out throughout your article is oftentimes how contradictory the ideals of womanhood actually are in order to kind of keep women on the hamster wheel of always pursuing the next kind of thing to further perform their identity of womanhood. So yeah, I just found that really interesting in terms of, you know, Prescott doing this really interesting, quite detailed, you know, music analysis in the girl's own paper, and that being juxtaposed, you know, and surrounded by articles about clothing and about manners and about cooking and motherhood and all sorts of things. And so, yeah, I just found that so interesting in terms of how the ideals of womanhood are being presented to women, and how, yeah, oftentimes you're kind of stuck in the middle. You can't really win in terms of these contradictory views on womanhood.
Exactly. And I mean, one thing that's so interesting is Olivera Prescott had a lot of things going for her, right? I mean, she was white. She wasn't super wealthy, but she was of a stable kind of upper middle class. Mm-hmm. So she had money to be educated both privately. And she went to the Royal Academy of Music and studied with George McFerrin, who was a super famous composer in England at the time, right? So she had all of these opportunities and kind of had everything going for her, right? But because women were not allowed to be professors of music theory at that time, they were kind of expected to stay in a certain sphere.
Right.
She was able to write about music theory in this particular context, a journal geared towards ladies, right? And deliver public lectures and write books about music for amateurs, right? But she wasn't allowed to be a music theory professor. Right. So there's this tension here between someone who has things that they think that they want to share. Right. They have thoughts they want to share, but because of the structures of power, are not able to share those in particular. Oh, they're limited in where they're able to share those. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so you also talk about her really getting into some discourse with some men about music towards the end of your article, in terms of arguments revolving around like logic and reason versus intuition, and, you know, the claim of, you know, men at the time and today, you know, that women, that their sphere is really intuition versus logic and reasoning, and that just not coming naturally to them, and that being a reason why women don't write great music, or why women can't be academics or intellectuals. And right. So, you know, she had some clapbacks to that as well, which was really spicy. I was so impressed, you know, by her responses to that critique in terms of, like, you know, the people that are best equipped to doing this work having elements of both intuition and reasoning, and that either sensibility is not, you know, shouldn't be demonized on its own, but that people contain both. And so to kind of separate those things arbitrarily and assign them to gender, and then assign, obviously, intuition as kind of the weaker sensibility because we're associating it with femininity, you know, she had some great responses to that, which I loved.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's something I think that the field of music theory is still dealing with, right? I mean, we've come far from that place, but I mean, we're still dealing with that. I mean, to same Suzanne Cusick's name again. I mean, one of the articles by her that I love the most is her 1993 or 1994 article about feminist theory, music theory, and the mind-body problem.
Yes.
Where she talks about this exact issue, right? About the kind of binary opposition between mind and body, between reason and intuition, and how that is structuring music theory and analysis in a particular way. For the worse, right? So it's an old binary oppositions, man. It's hard to get rid of those binary oppositions.
It is. And speaking of, you know, gender discourse around also the types of kind of intellectual pursuits that we expect men and women to kind of fall within, I also thought, you know, all of your commentary on her as a public music theorist, like you said, giving public lectures and writing for a public audience, and that was often pedagogical, right? That she was kind of instructing the ladies that were reading this paper about how they might think about music, or how they might, you know, play certain songs and things like that. You know, we associate kind of pedagogical research also with being less scholarly. And I also think that that is a gender discourse, right? That we would associate, right, you know, teaching as a more kind of feminine pursuit, I suppose, in juxtaposition to research, and that research is like what men in the academy do, and then teaching is what women do. And so the thought that research revolving around pedagogy itself is feminized and is kind of weaponized as not as rigorous, right, is so ludicrous to me. I was, again, back in 2020 when I was kind of getting into music theory and reading MTO and all that stuff, I was so delighted to discover the Journal of Music Theory Pedagogy, which I feel like is such an important publication in terms of the work that has been published through it. And I'm so happy that we as a field prioritize pedagogy, especially, again, when you consider, you know, the length of the history of music theory, that our field is basically entirely sprung out of pedagogy in terms of, like, if we as an academic discipline want to exist in the academy, you have to produce research, right? Like, as a field. But, like, composers and music teachers and people that were, like, teaching music theory at the time that wanted a reason to, like, be in the academy, it was like, well, we have to start producing research. So we did. But that entirely sprung out of, like, well, we just want to be able to teach in the academy. So, like, it's a field that is entirely sprung from pedagogy, and yet there's so much disrespect on pedagogy's name. And I won't stand for it. Not on my show. I love it.
Right. And I mean, I think that there's a certain, I think, you know, Steve Lett talks about this in his recent article in Spectrum about making a home for music theory, right? He talks about the very deliberate kind of disassociation from pedagogy that happened in the years surrounding the formation of SMT because of this binary, and because kind of the founders of our field wanted to make it seem like sciencey and legitimate.
Yes.
Because that's what was valued.
Right.
Kind of in academia more historically and more broadly at that time. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's nice to see a kind of move away from that. That said, I mean, I do think that still in music theory, there's still an issue with pedagogy not being considered as important, right, as other kinds of research. And I mean, one example of that is the lack of writing on pedagogy that has received publication awards, right?
Yes.
I mean, I was so happy to see Lee Van Handel, her book, the Routledge book, win a pedagogy award. I mean, it's a great book. Everyone should go out and check that book out. But it was really, really exciting to see that happen. But I know they founded the new award about pedagogy, which is great too. But I still do think that there's a kind of valuation that happens in our field where pedagogy is not seen as equal, right? And I mean, I think you can see that with journals too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a publication, in my opinion, there are many universities that would not view an article published in the Journal of Music Theory Pedagogy on the same kind of level of prestige as an article published in Music Theory Spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Absolutely. I still agree that there is a sort of hierarchy that still exists, even if the gap is kind of shrinking. I do.
Yeah.
I would agree that it still exists. And I'm thinking of Malia Jade Roberson, who's a professor at one of the California schools of music theory. She came on the podcast years ago now. Wow. To talk about her book that she published with Hal Leonard. And, you know, because it's a book, it's like a notebook that she published with Hal Leonard that she designed. So also she's like an amazing artist and graphic designer and designed this beautiful book and multiple books that she's published now with Hal Leonard around, it's like a music theory notebook. So it has like a sketch of a piano in it on every page. It's a mix of like staff paper and lined paper. It's like this beautifully designed book. And the fact that she has kind of received, you know, a bit of like criticism around those books not being important because they're, you know, rudimentary materials or whatever. But like, introductory foundational materials and curriculum is so hard to teach. It's not easy to like teach people to read music. It's not easy to teach people to understand their key signatures and things like that. That stuff needs as much pedagogical attention as, you know, more advanced analysis or post-tonal stuff or whatever. So it all takes talent and expertise and time dedicated, allotted to actually teach that stuff. But it gets so kind of, when Dr. Jen Miyake came on the show, she talked about the like soft skills of academia, meaning like learning how to like lesson plan or learning how to, right? Like those things are not easy to learn, but we rarely teach them in our pedagogy classes. Like we rarely teach students to teach. We teach them what they should be teaching and maybe the order that they should be structuring their classes and things like that. But nobody has taught me how to lesson plan. I had to you should have seen me last year. I was stumbling into this curriculum here at Michigan. So those things that are kind of assumed that or are natural, right? Again, particularly to women, right? Those things would just come naturally and they don't have to be taught. That's a lie. Like it has to be taught. It has to be learned over time. And there's work and effort that goes into teaching what we would call kind of introductory rudimentary materials or whatever. So yeah, I would echo your sentiments that the hierarchy still exists, even if the gap between different fields of research is kind of shrinking. I think it's still there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I love Mark Hannaford's work.
Yes.
One of your professors.
Shout out to my advisor, Mark Hannaford.
Oh, he's your advisor.
It's official. Okay, yes, he's my advisor.
Oh, congratulations. Yes. That's wonderful to hear. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love his work because he's really questioning, I think, what music theory can be and also like the modes of music theory making that that can happen. Mm. I mean, I'm thinking about his work about George Russell, right? And others, right? I mean, and others, but musicians who, you know, maybe delivered a lot of what they said orally or through lessons or through publications like the Hal Leonard book that you were describing, mm-hmm. right? That aren't considered like, you know, a published music theory treatise, right? But should be, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that is music theorizing,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. And again, it's teaching our students to music theorize through like such an ingenious kind of way through this notebook, like teaching students to connect maybe the notes that they're taking to the staff paper, to the piano, to the right, like learning to connect the senses that they work with every day. Right. And so those books are designed with so much thought in mind and care that for them to be kind of cast aside as not serious scholarship to me is just like not putting the respect on the field of pedagogy research that it really deserves. So I would definitely agree with your sentiments there. I also, you know, in the field of kind of public music theory, and especially as after this year's plenary session, a lot more people are kind of open to talking about it and what it is and what it does and how it redefines what a music theorist is. This is so funny. A professor here who was just hired in the last few years, Dr. Leah Frederick, who is fantastic, does research on music and math. She had kind of mentioned to me, and now I've been thinking about this, so I'm curious as to your thoughts on this. She mentioned to me after the plenary session, like, you know, that was so cool. It seems like, you know, you as kind of an expert in music theory, and I was like, an expert in public music theory. And I was like, oh, I don't know about that, but thank you. And she kind of brought to mind the question of like, what would it mean to write some sort of dissertation around public music theory. She was like, have you ever thought about that? I was like, no, mm-hmm. I have no idea what that would be or look like. And so I'm curious to know kind of as somebody who has done research in this subfield and has participated, you've been on another podcast and things like that, what you kind of think about the development of public music theory and what might be coming and how the participation might look in the future.
Oh my gosh. I don't know if I am at all qualified to answer that question. Oh my goodness. Boy. Well, like we were talking about earlier, I do feel like the field of music theory is more open mm-hmm. than it ever was before, mm-hmm. right? So I feel like you know, when I was writing a dissertation, if I had said, you know, I want to write a dissertation about public music theory and have part of the dissertation be a podcast, right? Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, I wouldn't have even imagined of proposing that idea.
Right.
Right.
I also can't imagine it. I cannot.
That type of thing. Right. But I think why not? Right. I mean, there's many different kinds of discourse that can be made and produced, and it doesn't all have to be like a written thing that goes into ProQuest that no one ever reads, right? I mean, if you think about it, there's actually precedent for this because a lot of composers who get their DMA in composition, part of the dissertation project is writing a piece
right.
or pieces That's that true. Is then performed, or performers have to do recitals.
Right.
So there actually is a precedent in my opinion, for work that is not just like a typed Word document of 250 pages with footnotes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the field is more open to that, again, in my opinion, than it ever has been. That said, I do think that we have to be careful about kind of how we're using public theory. And here I'm thinking about the recent MTO article by Katrina Kim and others.
Sure, yeah.
It's kind of talking about public theory and neoliberalism.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we do have to be really careful that we're not just establishing this hot new subfield of public music theory as a way to gain academic capital and prestige, right?
Sure.
I mean, I think that we do have to be careful about that. Like, why are we doing this? Who is getting credit?
Sure.
Right? How is this being judged? I mean, I do think that we have to be very careful about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an exact answer about that.
Right.
But yeah, I think we do have to be careful about that.
I would agree in terms of, if public music theory is going to begin to offer some sort of currency in the way of for building a tenure case and things like that, or for
right,
which can be really good, but also has things to consider. So it is a little sticky. It is a little complicated. And listeners, again, I'll put it in the show notes. You can go back, because I did have Katrina Kim and Alan Reese and Owen Belcher on the show. So you can go back and listen to us talk about that article that Rachel is referencing.
The reason that I'm thinking about this is because Music Theory Spectrum is going to do a special issue where they take the wonderful plenary talks and have people write responses to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me to write a response, and I'm going to write a response.
Oh, great.
But yeah, so I'm excited about that. But I do have, I told when they approached me about it, I did have to think about it for a while for this very reason,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there seemed to be something inherently contradictory about this journal, Music Theory Spectrum, which, let's be honest, nobody really reads. I mean, music theory,
we read it, but
this is not the New York Times.
Yes.
Right. I mean, this is not the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's behind a paywall.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I did have very mixed, and I still do have very mixed feelings about like writing something about public music theory for this journal that is actually not public. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean about the kind of being careful about like how this is being used. I'm probably going to talk about that in my response a little bit. I'm still thinking about it. But I mean, I said yes. Right. So I guess I'm part of the problem. I don't know.
Well, it's an interesting discourse, because when we see it, you know, presented here with Prescott and in the girl's own paper, it's clearly being used to empower. Right.
Yes.
To empower women to actually think that they can enter into intellectual discourse, that they can think critically, that they can trust their ears, and that they can engage with music in an intellectual way, right? So that was kind of the purpose as to why, you know, she felt emboldened to do so, because she was a woman who was doing so and knew that women could also participate in this musical activity and discussion, and that they just shouldn't count themselves out because it's not a ladies' place or something like that, right?
Right.
So here we see it so clearly displayed in terms of like breaking barriers for women versus, right. You're right, that we have to interrogate as people that are invested in public music theory, what are we getting out of it and what are our goals, right? Who is our target audience and what do we want them to be able to gain from engaging with our work? In terms of when, right. I started the show, I knew coming into the field, again, this when I was first starting to read about music theory and consider getting my PhD, it was 2020. So, you know, so much was happening in terms of the BLM movement that year. So much was happening after the 2019 plenary that, like, I was kind of entering into, dipping a toe into and being like, what is happening here? You're telling me the society's 1% Black? Oh, you know, so I was kind of entering into the field and I'm still entering in a really pivotal kind of turning point post that you know, 2019 plenary session, to where it was like, oh, I'm recognizing that there are not a lot of theorists that look like me, that the society is still around 1/3 women, that right, like I'm kind of looking at this field that I'm getting into and knowing that I just felt a deep sense of like, of dread in that, like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, what if it's going to be so much harder to like graduate and so much harder to get my work published or recognized, or, you know, like seeing so clearly displayed in front of me the barriers that I was going to be facing that I was like willingly entering into. And that was when I got the idea, like, I just want to have my own space to talk about things because mm-hmm. I'm worried that a space will not be made for me, which right. means I'm just going to make it. And I want to have conversations about music and facilitate the types of discussions that I hope that the field will enter into alongside me. And that was kind of what the podcast was born out of, was just wanting to create a space to have important discussions about identity in music academia that I didn't see happening and that I wanted a space to facilitate. And so knowing that, we just have to, like you're saying, we do have to really examine carefully what the motivations are behind music theory. And again, I didn't start it with any sort of like, I'm doing this because this is going to get me hired. Like, it's
right. right.
But it was really about like, if the field doesn't create a safe space for me, how can I empower myself to create a safe space and invite others into participating in it with me rather than waiting on the field to do something? So that was kind of where that came from. And we do have to be really careful about, like, are we doing this because we feel like we personally are going to benefit, our careers are going to benefit or something like that, versus, right, like making accessibility the goal, right? And making facilitating the discussions for folks that are left out of the conversation the goal.
Yeah. I love that we're back to talking about this issue of conversations, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so with the podcast, you have made a space to converse, right? And have conversations, the conversations that you want to have, right? Because you invite the speakers. Mm-hmm. And to have those conversations be heard and listened to by others, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and invite other people to engage in terms of, yes, a lot of the guests on the show are people that I ask, would you be interested in being on the show? But a lot of people have reached out and said, you know, I want to be involved with the show. I'm a listener of the show. I just really like the show. Can I recommend that you read this book? Or can I recommend that you listen to this music? Or I do this such and such at this institution, and I would love to be on the show. And so many people that I've written in that are listeners of the show have now become guests on the show. So there's also, you know, a two-way dialogue happening where I'm definitely not presenting myself as the authority on music right. theory or something like that. Y'all know I just got here. But, you know, it's a two-way street in that the audience can respond back, which isn't often the case in academic journals. I mean, yes, people write reviews and, you know, there is an academic dialogue that's happening. But in terms of the public, again, the public being able to respond back, anybody can come across the podcast, anybody can come across my website and send me the email, hermesgeekacademia.com. It's a public email, you know, that people can reach out to me with their thoughts on the show. And again, even get involved in the show by coming on or by recommending something that I end up talking about. So I really invite the public to engage in a way that journals are just not able to do because they're just not as accessible. And again, you also brought up the issue of notation in terms of feeling like a real barrier to people that can't right. read music or that don't have formal training, feeling like they're not intelligent enough to participate in the conversation versus, you know, an audio only medium where like you just get to hear us talk. We get to actually listen to music and I get to play audio drops and we get to, mm-hmm. you know, have conversations that hopefully feel devoid of kind of the barriers that come with reading a music theory article and getting spooked by the notation. We don't have that here. And so hopefully anybody who is a musician or isn't a musician or is in the academy or isn't in the academy can find some value in the show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think with a conversation, right, a true conversation is a process of exchange, right? I mean, one person talks and the other person listens mm-hmm. and they respond. And then it happens again, right? So, I mean, that's the thing that's exciting to me about your podcast and other kinds of public music theory, that we can be both speakers and listeners. Yes. And there's this exchange there that's exciting to me.
And that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Rachel Lumsden for being on the show today. As I mentioned earlier, her work was some of the first music theory scholarship I had ever read, and it taught me so much about how expansive music theory actually is and can be and what it can do. Make sure you check the show notes for the links to everything that we mentioned during our conversation. If you want to get in touch with me to talk about the show, if you have comments or feedback or questions about the show, if you just listened to this whole 8-episode season and you're like, dang, I didn't get on the podcast this season, and you want to change that and you want to get on the podcast next season, please send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, and fill out the contact form there. We are always looking for guests, so don't be shy. Let's definitely get you involved with the show. I will talk to y'all at the end of the semester with my Semester in Review episode. Thanks so much for your support this past season. Thank you for listening and tuning in every Monday. And I can't wait to catch up with y'all soon. Until next time, thanks for listening.